Hello, ahlan wa sahlan, and welcome to another episode of Arab Voices, a syndicated radio talk show that airs on dozens of radio stations in the US and Europe since 2002. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. During this episode of Arab Voices, episode number 1207, I will have four segments. First, we will listen to the Electronic Intifada newscast, a summary of the latest developments in occupied Palestine, including the ongoing Israeli genocide in the Gaza Strip and the ongoing Israeli atrocities in the occupied West Bank and Jerusalem. After that, I will air a segment from Breakthrough News titled Israel Brings Gaza Doctrine to Lebanon, Rania Khaliq Reports from Beirut, in which Rania Khaliq, an award-winning Lebanese-American journalist and host of Dispatches on Breakthrough News, talks about the Israeli orders to displace hundreds of thousands from South Lebanon as it intensifies its war on Iran and its attacks on Lebanon. During the third segment, we will listen to a podcast from David Hurst, editor-in-chief of Middle East Eye, titled Israel's War of Regional Supremacy Will Not End with Iran. And after that, I will air a segment from Breakthrough News titled Greater Israel Explained, the Israeli Plan to Conquer the Arab World. Let's begin with the Electronic Intifada newscast, a summary of the latest developments in occupied Palestine, presented by Noura Burrows-Friedman, associate editor at the Electronic Intifada.
This is the Electronic Intifada newscast. I'm Noura Burrows-Friedman, associate editor at the Electronic Intifada. It's day 881 of Israel's genocide in Gaza. Here's a brief summary of some of the latest developments this week in Palestine. Israeli forces continued to violate the fraudulent ceasefire in Gaza this week, killing Palestinians and reimposing a total closure of the crossings to humanitarian aid, food, fuel, and medicine. In the town of Bani Suhaila near Khan Yunis on Wednesday, Israeli soldiers shot and killed two Palestinians, Montasser Samour and Maher Samour. According to local news sources, an Israeli military unit abducted the two men and took them across the so-called yellow line, detained them, and shot them. Reporter Tamer Keshta captured video footage and eyewitness testimony from residents who said that the Israeli army returned Montasser Samour's body riddled with bullets while Maher Samour was shot and killed in what witnesses described as a field execution. One man showing the journalist the wounds on one of the men's body says, quote, "This is torture. They kidnapped him and threw his body at the Al-Karara Bridge. A witness said one man was shot in the chest and ran. He fell and was martyred. This one was shot in the legs. They took him and fled. When we brought him here, his whole chest, his whole abdomen was full of bullets. Executed. The witness said the men were going to pick radishes and chard for their families. They were staying and living there. He was a caretaker in a destroyed house on land near the yellow line. He slept and lived there day after day, night after night. We're on that land every day." Anadolu News Agency reported that earlier in the day, heavy gunfire from Israeli military vehicles stationed east of the so-called Yellow Line was reported in those areas near Khan Yunis, and that Israeli artillery also targeted neighborhoods east of Gaza City, while Israeli gunboats fired toward the coastline. Last week, on February 26th, Israeli warplanes targeted a Palestinian police checkpoint at the entrance to the Burej refugee camp in central Gaza, killing at least one police officer and injuring another, according to the Palestinian Ministry of the Interior and National Security. The Ministry of Health in Gaza reported on Wednesday that since the so-called ceasefire went into effect nearly 5 months ago, at least 633 Palestinians have been killed and more than 1,700 have been injured. In the same time period, the health ministry stated that more than 750 bodies of Palestinians have been recovered so far from underneath the rubble after more than 2 years of genocide. The Civil Defense Corps in northern Gaza stated this week that they had finished a nine-day operation that they called the Dignity of Martyrs campaign, in which they recovered 93 bodies of Palestinians killed in Israeli airstrikes and buried beneath collapsed homes. In the absence of heavy equipment and fuel to operate machinery, which continued to be blocked by the Israelis, the civil defense workers used their hands and simple tools to retrieve the human remains. The civil defense said that more than 500 bodies remain under the rubble, denying surviving family members the dignity of properly burying their loved ones. Civil defense worker Mohamed Loai filmed himself and his colleagues working tirelessly in the mountains of rubble, and said that they are working to renew the campaign in order to retrieve all of the bodies in that area. In the immediate aftermath of the U.S.-Israeli attacks on Iran that began over the weekend, the Israeli government and military closed all of the crossings into and out of Gaza, further exacerbating the humanitarian and infrastructure crisis. On Tuesday, the Kerem Shalom or Kerem Abu Salem crossing in the south of Gaza was partially opened, but all other crossings have remained closed, including the Rafah crossing at the Egyptian border, which had been partially reopened since early February and was used for people returning to Gaza and medical evacuations from Gaza. In addition, according to the Tel Aviv newspaper Haaretz, the Allenby Bridge crossing between Jordan and the West Bank has likewise been closed to goods and humanitarian aid following a decision by the Israeli Airports Authority, which oversees the crossing. Writing in the LA Times this week, Ahmed Khan of the eponymous humanitarian aid organization, the Ahmed Khan Foundation, stated that, quote, for more than 5 months, 15,000 boxes of children's cold medicine and other vital medicines meant for kids in the Gaza Strip have been sitting in a warehouse awaiting approval from Israeli authorities that never seems to come. To Israeli officials, the cold medicine I am trying to deliver is a potential weapon, he adds. Quote, Israeli officials fear that Hamas will steal the bottles and transform the small amounts of glycerin in the medicine to make explosives, despite there being no evidence that armed groups in Gaza have done or could do this. Israel has refused to clarify what percentage of glycerin would be allowed, so we can't even source an alternative that would be assured of clearance. The medicine remains in a warehouse while children in Gaza continue to die because they can't get basic treatments. Meanwhile, the United Nations Humanitarian Office stated that between the October 2025 so-called ceasefire and until mid-February, quote, an additional 853 people have reportedly acquired new disabilities. This includes 496 new amputations, 186 spinal cord injuries, and 171 traumatic brain injuries. The UN added that despite rising needs, assistive products, including prosthetics, continue to be classified by the Israeli authorities as dual-use items, which severely restricts their entry into the Gaza Strip. During this period, only 300 artificial limbs were allowed to enter Gaza under the health cluster framework, while the cumulative number of amputations since October 2023 now exceeds 5,000, in addition to the 496 new amputations recorded since the ceasefire. Shelter materials are also being heavily restricted by Israel. According to the UN spokesperson Stefan Dujarric on Wednesday, if the rainy season continues, hundreds of thousands of people whose homes have been destroyed remain at risk of flooding in their dilapidated tents. Dujarric said that 8 temporary relocation sites have been established in Gaza, but critical materials remain out of reach. Quote, we and our partners still do not have the tools and the materials to make shelters that are longer lasting, he said, noting that the entry of these supplies continues to be heavily restricted and they're difficult to find on the local markets. Such supplies include toolkits, timber and cement to repair homes, and heavy machinery to clear rubble and to make more space for dignified housing. Turning to the occupied West Bank, dozens of Israeli settlers attacked the village of Karyut near Nablus in the north on Tuesday. One of the attacking settlers is a reservist soldier who shot and killed two Palestinian men, Mohammed Taha Mu'ammar, who was shot in the head, and his brother Fahim Taha Mu'ammar, who was shot in his lower body. Eyewitnesses reported that armed settlers carrying rifles and iron bars stormed homes in the southern part of the village and opened fire on residents. At least 3 other people were injured in the attack, according to Middle East Monitor, including a 30-year-old man with a shoulder wound, a 32-year-old man with a knee injury, and a 15-year-old boy who sustained a gunshot wound to the shoulder. Also on Tuesday, Israeli forces opened fire on a Palestinian man and a child in the Askar refugee camp east of Nablus on the 2nd consecutive day of invasions and raids by the army. The Palestine Red Crescent Society reported that its teams treated a 20-year-old young man who was shot in the foot with live bullets, and an 11-year-old child who was shot in the hand. The army conducted home raids and subjected residents to interrogations, the local Wafa news agency reported. On Wednesday, Wafa reported that Israeli soldiers shot and injured 5 Palestinians in Jenin during an invasion in the central part of the city. A medical source at Al-Razi Hospital in Jenin told the news agency that among the injured was a young man who was shot in the back, with the bullet exiting through his chest, leaving him in critical condition. And in Jerusalem, Israeli occupation authorities closed the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound since the U.S. and Israel launched attacks on Iran, preventing worshippers from entering the mosque and the surrounding courtyards during Ramadan. Israeli forces have imposed an almost complete closure of the occupied West Bank since Saturday's attacks on Iran, locking barriers and gates and closing all checkpoints until, quote, further notice, as Kogat, the Israeli military's bureaucratic wing, said on February 28th. We've published many features in the last week, but we wanted to highlight Saving Lives at a Time of Slaughter by Samah Zahir Zakut, writing from Gaza. Zakut profiles Dr. Bakr Abu Safiya, a 65-year-old senior surgeon who worked at Al-Awda Hospital in Jabalia, northern Gaza, at the beginning of Israel's genocide. He recounts how he barely escaped death while treating his patients, narrowly avoiding an Israeli sniper's bullet inside the hospital in 2024. Despite all this danger, Dr. Bakr Abu Safiya pushed himself beyond the limits, refusing to leave his patients, as he said, was the only surgeon in northern Gaza, Zakut writes. On October 16, 2024, Dr. Bakr was managing two operating rooms simultaneously, he said, while two other critical patients waited in the reception area. Meanwhile, his cousin, Dr. Hussam Abu Safiya, transferred to him four cases, and in less than half an hour later, he sent 10 more. But Bakr Abu Safiya sorted through these other cases and kept working from 3 p.m. until 2:45 a.m., where in 12 hours, he performed 14 surgeries, including three cases that needed kidney removal and other cases involving damaged spleens, livers, or intestines. Abu Safiya would sometimes perform surgeries that were not his specialty. His erstwhile colleague, Dr. Saeed Judah, would sometimes send him vascular surgery cases. It wasn't my specialty, but I had studied it, and since no one else was there, I did the surgeries, Abu Safiya said. I never failed a surgery. Some patients needed to be transferred to Gaza City for plastic or orthopedic surgery, but since many couldn't, I did two orthopedic surgeries myself, even though it wasn't my specialty. Abu Safiya said that what caused him deep psychological pain, which still affects him, is losing coworkers or watching them get detained. On December 12, 2024, Dr. Saeed Judah was killed when an Israeli tank fired at the car he was in, marked with a red crescent sign and a white flag. Not long after, the Israeli army abducted Dr. Hussam Abu Safiya on December 27, 2024. He's still suffering in Israeli dungeons. Before the January 2025 ceasefire was announced, the Israeli army besieged Al-Awda Hospital for the third time, blocking all the roads that surrounded the hospital with sand barriers, allowing no cars or even ambulances to get through. The hospital relied on a small generator to run medical equipment for a few hours daily. Its staff used the remaining fuel to power the operating rooms, reception, and lab, limiting surgical procedures to life-saving cases. Abu Safiya said that they had to carry the wounded to the operating rooms with help from others as there were no elevators. I can never forget an 8-year-old boy who begged me not to cut his leg, Abu Safiya said. I promised him that I will do everything I can to save it. And we did. After the ceasefire was announced in January 2025, Abu Safiya's family returned to northern Gaza. When Abu Safiya reunited with them and saw his children, he was shocked by how they looked, something that broke him from the inside. They looked tanned and had lost a lot of weight, he said. After Israel unilaterally ended the January ceasefire, the Israeli army besieged the hospital for the fourth and last time. It was the worst, Abu Safiya said. I was the only surgeon in northern Gaza, the sole specialist in everything. Even in total darkness and without internet or phone service, we kept working as best we could. The area was emptied and we were the last to leave, Abu Safiya said of the Israeli army ordering them to evacuate on June 28, 2025. Those still in Al-Awda Hospital left in Health Ministry-coordinated vehicles from northern Gaza to Gaza City, he said, as there was nothing left. There were no supplies, no food, no water, Abu Safiya said. The hospital could no longer function. No one could reach the hospital thereafter. After the so-called October 2025 ceasefire, Al-Awda Hospital was located behind Israel's new yellow line. Abu Safiya returned with his family to another apartment he has in Gaza City, since this first one is uninhabitable after being burned by the Israeli army. But we endure. I continue to work, he said, of working in Al-Awda Hospital in Nusayrat. Inshallah, this will ease one day. Those are excerpts from Saving Lives at a Time of Slaughter by Samah Zahir Zakout, a lecturer at the University College of Applied Sciences, an online tutor, and a translator, writing from Gaza on electronicintifada.net. And now, as we always do, we wanted to highlight people expressing joy, determination, and reclamation across Palestine and around the world. In Gaza, the paracycling team and mutual aid organization, the Gaza Sunbirds, rehabilitated an area in the Burej refugee camp in central Gaza to build a volleyball court for the children. They say, quote, 52% of our land is now occupied. We're here at the yellow line in Burej camp, claiming our streets through sports and tradition. This volleyball court is one of many activities we have planned to bring sports to every corner of the strip. Ramadan Kareem to you all from Gaza, the Sunbirds say. And that's it for the news roundup. As always, go to electronicintifada.net for much more, especially to read our new features by our brave writers in Gaza. You've been listening to the Electronic Intifada's newscast. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. Want to hear more? Check out our live stream with interviews, reports, and analysis, along with print articles, podcasts, and more at electronicintifada.net. Produced by Nora Barrows-Friedman, Tamara Nassar, and Pierre Loisel.
You're listening to Arab Voices, a syndicated radio talk show that airs on dozens of radio stations in the US and Europe since 2002. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Apartheid Israel continues to excel at what it does best, and that is attacking others, creating wars, and causing massive displacements, death, and destruction. The ongoing genocide against the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip is apparently not enough for Apartheid Israel, so it decided to expand its war crimes against others by launching a war on Iran, expanding and escalating its ongoing atrocities and attacks on Lebanon, and who knows what is next, as Apartheid Israel seems to speed up its plan for the so-called Greater Israel, and more on that later during this show. So what is going on in Lebanon? I'm going to share with you now a portion of an interview Eugene Poirier, an American journalist, author, activist, and host on Breakthrough News, conducted with Rania Khaliq, titled Israel Brings Gaza Doctrine to Lebanon. Rania Khaliq reports from Beirut. Rania is an award-winning Lebanese-American journalist and host of Dispatches on Breakthrough News. Let's take a listen.
But of course, you are there in Lebanon, and I'm sure people are seeing the images, terrible Israeli destruction in Lebanon and seemingly continue moving forward. So I just wanted to give you an opportunity to, you know, give folks a lay of the land.
Well, Eugene, today is day 4 of the massive escalation against Lebanon. It's day 6 of the U.S.-Israeli launch of the war on Iran. But because Iran is like basically the big story and what's happening in the region, Lebanon's gotten a lot less attention. But today, you know, I think things have deteriorated quite rapidly here. But today deteriorated even more. Everyone edge after this afternoon, the Israelis, the Israeli Arabic language spokespeople issued a directive demanding people leave the southern suburbs of Beirut, known as Dahi, home to hundreds of thousands of people. Basically, they call it an evacuation order, but these are displacement orders. They said hundreds of people must leave to save their own lives. They want to empty the entire southern suburbs of Beirut out. And of course, this caused massive chaos, massive traffic. This also comes after demanding the evacuation of Lebanon entire south of the Latani River days earlier. This new displacement order of, again, hundreds of thousands of people who live in the suburbs of Beirut, majority Shia. Israel sees it as, you know, Hezbollah's base of support. You constantly hear this area of Beirut referred to as a Hezbollah stronghold. This is where Israel typically centers its bombing campaign in the capital around. This is unprecedented, even for the Israelis. Israel is trying to empty out huge portions of the country like never before. Most of the global media is understandably consumed with the war on Iran. So this isn't really getting the attention it deserves. But it's, again, unprecedented. It's also notable that the Israelis are telling the Lebanese in their tweets about demanding that they evacuate. They were telling these Lebanese people that they're displacing from these Shia neighborhoods to take roads to areas of the country, which would inevitably land them in Christian or Sunni areas, which also leads into Israel trying to create sectarian civil chaos in this country, which is another aspect of this that I'll get to. But all that's to say, Israel issuing a mass directive for hundreds of thousands of people to evacuate an entire part of the city that's so densely populated suggests that they are going to massively carpet bomb the entire area. So people were basically fleeing for their lives all afternoon and evening with really nowhere to go. You had people in other parts of Beirut really scared about what this would mean for the city in general, you know, opening their windows in case there's massive blasts so that their windows don't break. Just a really scared, panicked situation in the city. It seems as though Israel is flying its Gaza doctrine to Tehran, to South Lebanon, now to the southern suburbs of Beirut. They're totally unleashed with no red lines, this genocidal fascist state with the full backing of the U.S. military in the region right now. It really is, Eugene, a terrifying and shameful moment for humanity. I mean, as the last 2.5 years. Bannon, you also had Israeli Minister Bezalel Smotrich making a statement, I believe, from the north, from Israel's north, saying that Beirut's Dahiyeh district will soon look like Khan Yunis in Gaza. So basically promising to turn it into Gaza. So that's just the most recent development in Lebanon, and everybody's on edge, you know, eyes glued to the live feeds on Lebanese news channels of various parts of the country, but waiting to see what Israel's going to do in Dahiyeh, waiting to see what they're going to do. That it's next to the airport itself. The country is so on edge. And that's, you know, on top of the last several days of massive Israeli bombing. The Lebanese health ministry said just today that the death toll from these renewed Israeli attacks has risen to 77 and then 525 wounded. Before this recent displacement order in Dahiyeh, there was already 84,000 people displaced across the country. Because again, like I said, the Israelis had issued these displacement orders for over 100 villages in the south, over 100 villages in the south, saying leave your village. And I'll get to what the actual goal is for that. But I just want to say, just to give people background, been kind of distracted by the other big news out of the region. This all started on Monday morning. And, you know, it didn't really start on Monday morning, but this recent escalation started Monday morning when Hezbollah fired a handful of rockets into the northern Israeli area. And they said in their statement that they released soon after that it was to avenge the death of Iran's supreme leader, Ali Khamenei. And it was in response to the endless ceasefire violations, over 15,000 since November 2024. Israel has violated the ceasefire daily. They had killed by that point, since that ceasefire, over 350 Lebanese and injured many. Hezbollah had not once in those 15 months. And so they framed this as a response to that. And it was a handful of rockets, none of which actually caused any damage. Most of them were intercepted. And then, you know, Israel right after that unleashed hell. I actually was woke up in the middle of the night at 3 a.m. to the sound of Israel bombing Dahiyeh on that early Monday morning. Most of the rest of the city heard those bombings as well. They were incredibly intense. And then it just got worse and worse after that. It was like a repeat of, you know, September 2024, but somehow even worse because everybody's already been displaced not too long ago. Some people had just finished rebuilding their houses to only have them bombed again. There are displaced people all over the city, all over different parts of the country. My neighborhood, it looks like it looked in November 2024 when it was just, you know, full of displaced people with nowhere to go, with a drone overhead. But this time around, there's, you know, far less appetite for war. And you know, on top of that, you know, I just want to go back to the issue of Israel wanting to stoke civil chaos. Again, there are tens of thousands of people displaced. That number is going to rise from the 84,000 number that I already mentioned because of these recent displacement orders. And, you know, the reason, if anybody noticed earlier in the broadcast, I kept looking down, it's because I'm watching my phone to see updates from the Israeli spokespeople. It's so dystopian, Eugene. We literally have them have these people on notification so we can see where they're going to bomb next when they give their displacement orders. That is how we are living in Lebanon right now. And they do it mostly overnight, so it's very difficult to sleep. But all that's to say, these tens of thousands of people that are displaced, and there will be more as Israel widens its scope and issues more evacuation orders, including more recently in the Bekaa Raqqa. And Israel's also bombed safe places. Like a couple days ago, they bombed Hazmi, which is in the suburbs of Beirut. It's a Christian area that's considered safe. A hotel there, never explained why or what looking for, and they injured severely the receptionist there, just kind of making everybody feel like nowhere is safe. This is intended to make everybody feel unsafe and to fuel unrest, because like I said, the Lebanese are very tired. They have no appetite for another war. And I also have to say that has led to a great deal of anger at Hezbollah for entering into this war. Hezbollah was already domestically weakened, and many had blamed them for the losses that were experienced in 2024 and the big escalation then. And so many in Lebanon see this latest Israeli escalation. They're blaming Hezbollah for it. And especially from the more sectarian right-wing voices in this country, they are really going to town to incite hatred, not just against Hezbollah, but against the constituency they represent, against all the Shia of Lebanon, against the very people that through no fault of their own, through Israel's fault, are being displaced right now. So again, I go back to little appetite, not just for war, but in a polarized sectarian country like Lebanon, where there's so much incitement to hatred, there's also now little appetite to even help the displaced. So people literally have fewer places to go than they had back in September, October, November, 2024. It's a very horrible and unfair situation, but that is the material reality of Lebanon right now. And the Israelis are trying to take advantage of that. They know that bombing quote unquote safe areas will be blamed on Hezbollah and on Shia specifically, and therefore risk sectarian infighting. And again, I go back to in the displacement orders they issued for Dahi earlier, they literally gave instructions for where to go. And they basically told people to go to like a road that would take them either to Christian areas or a road that would take them to Sunni areas. They want to see civil chaos in this country. And, you know, I also want to go back to the displacement orders in the south, because Israel has also invaded the south. But I would also say that it's not entirely correct to call what Israel's doing simply an invasion, because an invasion would suggest an eventual departure. The Israelis plan on a permanent occupation of the villages they enter in South Lebanon. That's what the Israeli military spokespeople mean when they say things like, and I'm quoting one of them, framing it as a tactical step to create an additional layer of security for the residents of northern Israel. They plan to stay and hold the territory they take. So the displacement notices they're issuing are meant to empty South Lebanon of Lebanese for what they hope will be forever. This is all about stealing land for greater Israel. And sadly, so far, the Lebanese government response has been much like it's been for the past 15 months, but now on steroids. Now, for the last 15 months, the Lebanese government has done almost nothing. They have done nothing to try to protect the people who've been subjected to constant Israeli bombings and raids in the south. In fact, instead, they've had the U.S. gun to their head, and they have basically tasked the Lebanese army with disarming Hezbollah south of the Latani River. So basically taking away the ability of the people of the south to defend themselves against Israeli aggression. And after one day, the Lebanese government ordered Hezbollah to disarm and labeled Hezbollah's military actions as illegal and any further actions as illegal, and its military wing as illegal. They basically banned it. And to just to show how isolated domestically Hezbollah has become, even their ally on Monday, Nabih Birri of the ML movement, essentially backed the government's measures, demonstrating, I think, a new level of isolation for this group in this country domestically. And a part of that had to do with the fact that, you know, he was the one who was acting as an interlocutor between, you know, Hezbollah and the government in many ways, like a promising, you know, they're giving assurances basically to the government that Hezbollah had promised they wouldn't get involved in this war, in this U.S. war with Iran. And since then, the Lebanese government has also basically ordered the army to retreat from the south. I mean, and again, this has happened. It's a very difficult balance because the army does not have the capability to even fight the Israelis. They don't have the weapons for it. And on top of that, the donor countries to the army are all countries that wouldn't allow that anyway. So it's, you know, to be in the Lebanese army is a tough position to be in. But basically, they've also got the army policing people from going back to the south if they try, especially if they have weapons. And so they've actually arrested a number of people who were going towards the south with weapons, Lebanese people, I mean. And even more recently today, the Lebanese government banned the IRGC in Lebanon and said so that's like a new, basically trying to please the Americans and Israelis is like a desperate measure to get them to stop what they're doing, because this is a nightmare for everyone in Lebanon. And again, this is not a justification for the behavior of the Lebanese government at all, but they do have guns to their heads. And you know, Hezbollah has given reasons for why they did this, entered this war. They insist that they had no choice to use what they saw as a strategic opportunity to hit back at the Israelis for 15 months of ceasefire violations that they sat on their hands for and didn't answer until now. And then, you know, also in their statement, they did say it was to avenge the death of Ali Khamenei, which was kind of bad for the optics in this country, because, you know, by the people who hate them, Hezbollah is framed as being an extension of Iran. So the fact that they said that in the statement just kind of gave more fuel to that fire. But regardless, you know, very few people, Eugene, expected them to enter this war, given that they've been militarily and domestically weakened in this country since the big war that we had in 2024. And there do remain some serious questions as to why they decided to intervene now and to what end. And that includes even, you know, those questions are coming out even among some of their supporters. And, you know, Hezbollah has also said that they entered this war not just because of the ceasefire violations, but also they say that Israel was planning a preemptive attack on Lebanon. So they were preempting Israel's preemption. That's also caused a lot of debate. And, you know, I want to say the Lebanese absolutely have a right to armed resistance against Israel. Any people do against a settler colonial entity. The Lebanese government, like I said, with a U.S. gun to their head, has done nothing to protect its people. Since November 2024, only Hezbollah has abided by that ceasefire. Israel's bombed Lebanon near every single day for the last 15 months. And, you know, I just keep reiterating that because it's very, very important to remember. But that said, you know, Israel right now is many could argue, at its strongest with the full force of the U.S. military stationed in this region. And the Israelis did spend all of last week before the Iran war was launched threatening to destroy Lebanon, including its civilian infrastructure, if Hezbollah were to get involved in this war. So many are saying, you know, you knew what the cost of would be. And now that's what we see happening. And it's just a complete disaster. It's very scary. We're only in day four. And because of the impunity given to Israel since the Gaza genocide, I mean, you could argue since before that, but since the Gaza genocide especially, there's very few forces in the world who will even raise their voice against what's happening here. And again, I go back to the fact that it's really getting drowned out by the news on Iran. So here we are once again, displacement orders, the leveling of buildings, and having to navigate this insane situation where you don't know where is safe, because even the safe places get bombed. And this is significantly more dangerous than what we saw in 2024 because of the intensity of polarization in this country and all of what I explained about the way that people have blamed Hezbollah, blamed the Shia community. And if Israel's displacing half the country, where are they going to go? They're going to go to areas full of people who have very negative views of them. And that is just a recipe for conflict. And during the Lebanese civil war, like a traffic dispute between two people on different political and sectarian sides could result in, you know, a big battle where lots of people end up dead. And that's where everyone's minds go in this kind of situation.
Well, I appreciate that. And I appreciate the comprehensive nature of what you've been able to bring to the forefront. And we are very happy to be able to have those perspectives, which I think are very unique anywhere on your dial, to use an old TV term. And I don't really have that much to add. I thought that was very comprehensive. All I'll say is, do not sound like a broken drum. You got to believe people when they tell you something in the first place. And Marco Rubio already said it. New colonial crusade, genocide, land grabs, occupations, mass murder, divisions of people, the establishment of puppet governments, and the Greater Israel Project is super crucial to this new colonial crusade. And they're telling us how they're moving. And I think that it's incumbent upon people who it's being done in our name, that we raise our voices against that, because I agree with you. It's unbelievably terrible, tragic, unprovoked, you know, criminal, really, what's happening in Lebanon, what's happening all across West Asia. And yes, I thought very well stated on your part. And I just want to again plug Dispatches, which is doing many different episodes on many different things and is getting many different backgrounds on all of these different points. If you go to our website, breakthroughnews.org, or check us out on social media, we have a newsletter that we're putting together with daily events that are going on in the region where you can follow it. I don't know, there's a big siren behind me right now, so I don't know if you can still hear me, but nonetheless, please just keep following us, and we're going to do the best we can to cover all angles of this as much and as in-depth as we can.
That was a portion of an interview Breakthrough News conducted with Rania Khaliq, an award-winning Lebanese-American journalist and host of Dispatches on Breakthrough News, while she was in Lebanon. More information about Breakthrough News is at breakthroughnews.org. You're listening to Arab Voices, a syndicated radio talk show that airs on dozens of radio stations in the U.S. and Europe since 2002. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. David Hurst, editor-in-chief of Middle East Eye, said in a recent podcast that the U.S. and Israeli strike on Iran marks the start of a war aimed not at Iran's nuclear program, but at regime change. He says Iran had just made what Oman described as a substantial offer in negotiations with Washington to dilute its stock of highly enriched uranium. Yet the talks served as cover for what he describes as a pre-planned decapitation strike. He says that weakening Iran is central to a broader Israeli project increasingly described as, quote, Greater Israel, unquote. The idea that Israeli power should extend across the region. Let's listen to that podcast from David Hurst, editor-in-chief of Middle East Eye, titled Israel's War of Regional Supremacy Will Not End with Iran.
Israelis and some in the Iranian diaspora celebrated when the first blow in the third Gulf War was struck early on Saturday morning. Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, and dozens of other military and political leaders were wiped out. Iran had just made what the Omani foreign minister described as a substantial offer in the talks with the Americans on their uranium enrichment program. They had offered to dilute their stock of highly enriched uranium so that it could no longer be used as bomb-grade material. Donald Trump responded with war. In fact, the talks had been a sham all along. The CIA had been tracking Khamenei's movements for months, and all they were waiting for was a meeting when the top leadership would be gathered in his compound. It took place on Saturday, so that is when the war started. Trump and Benjamin Netanyahu then both spoke almost from the same script, appealing to Iranians to come out onto the streets and bring their regime down. It didn't happen. Iranians did take to the streets, but they did so largely as mourners. There were neighborhoods of Tehran where people cheered from their balconies, but there were screams from others too, and plenty who did neither but feared what was to come. From the first moments of the war, it was clear that this was about regime change, not uranium and not the missiles. Regime change was the very thing that Trump and the MAGA movement campaigned against, both as a candidate and as a president. Trump vowed in a speech in New Hampshire 3 years ago to demolish the deep state, those horrible warmongers, those stupid, stupid people, he said. Then, as president, he used a speech in Riyadh to say that the so-called nation builders had wrecked far more nations than they had built. Well, now he has joined the ranks of those stupid, stupid people. He is the president who is wrecking Iran, and he's hard put to say why. Was it the nukes? Was it help for the protesters who were mown down in their thousands in January? Was it their ballistic missiles? On Monday, his Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, added a fifth reason. He claimed that the US attacked because it knew Israel was poised to, and if that happened, the US forces would bear the brunt of the retaliation. Was Rubio admitting that this commander-in-chief had been led by the nose by Netanyahu into a third Gulf War? Trump tried to row back on that, but the truth is, he has been led by the nose. Netanyahu has been far more consistent. He's been planning for this day for the best part of 47 years. In his declaration of war, the Israeli premier pointedly addressed the Iranians by their ethnicities, not their nationality. He called them Persians, Kurds, Azeris, Balochs, Abkhaz. The bombs falling spoke to the same strategy. They targeted all members of the political elite, reformists, leftists, past presidents, as well as the principalists. This is not nation building, it's the dismantling of a nation. The purpose of Israel's war is to disable Iran as a regional power and turn it into a weak, pliant confederation of ethnic cantons. This is what he's been doing in Syria by feigning a sudden interest in the Druze and the Kurds. And that is why we have been seeing his pilots of the free world, he called them, bombing a school and massacring 180 people, most of them young boys and girls. And this is why Israel is now bombing Iranian hospitals. Israel is setting about dismantling the cities of Iran in the same way as it did Gaza and southern Lebanon. As a consequence, the casualties of this so-called pinpoint bombing have soared to more than 750 deaths in just 4 days. The destruction of Iran as a regional power is part of a bigger plan that would underpin two words increasingly on the lips of Israeli politicians, Greater Israel. This is a dream that Zionists of many hues have harbored for decades, that the modern state of Israel will one day run from the Nile to the Euphrates. It is no coincidence that weeks before this attack, the US ambassador to Israel, Mike Huckabee, said to Tucker Carlson that it would be fine if Israel took all the land from the Nile to the Euphrates. And no coincidence that Israel's opposition leader, Yair Lapid, immediately agreed. It's also no coincidence that shortly before launching this war, Netanyahu rolled out the red carpet carpet for Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi. India is already producing weapons for Israel, and Modi has promised to allow 50,000 more Indian citizens to work in Israel to replace Palestinian labor force. With support from India in place, Israel would become less dependent on funding, arms, and political support from Washington. The second point of this war is its timing. Netanyahu calculates that Israel will never again have a US president as easy to manipulate as Trump. No Republican or Democrat that comes after him will be as friendly. The genocide in Gaza has seen to that. This is thus the time not just to crush the Islamic Republic, but to fill the vacuum this creates to expand Israel's military and high-tech control over the region as a whole. An independent Iran is the only obstacle to Netanyahu realizing his project of establishing a new regional alliance, his so-called hexagon of states, with India to the east and Somaliland to the south. The Islamic Republic is now fighting for its life. Its leadership, so often dubbed fundamentalist, has in reality been too cautious. It has realized too late in the day that the war of annihilation Israel has been waging in Gaza, Lebanon, and Syria would arrive on its doorstep too. It negotiated with Trump, and each time the US treated the talks as cover for a military decapitation campaign. Iran made a fatal mistake on October the 7th when Hamas attacked southern Israel. Iran and Hezbollah rejected pleas by Hamas to start a second front on Israel's northern borders. The mistake was to listen to messaging from Joe Biden's administration not to get involved in a regional war in return for being allowed to sell more oil under the table. Thus, each component of the resistance of an occupied Palestine allowed themselves to be picked off one by one at Israel's timing and choice. Belatedly, Iran has learned this lesson and is now fighting a very different campaign to the one it fought when it was attacked for 12 days last year. Today, Iran's targets are the US diplomatic and military installations in the Gulf and its allies. Iran wants to make the international costs of attacking it as high as possible. So, within a matter of 24 hours, Iran had closed the Strait of Hormuz, pounded Dubai, halted Saudi Arabia's biggest oil refinery, and Doha's production and export of liquefied natural gas. Ships at the mouth of the Gulf are aflame. The Revolutionary Guards have just announced that they have control over Hormuz. Most flights in the region have been suspended. Oil and gas prices have surged. Iranian drones have also targeted a French military base in Abu Dhabi. And Hezbollah expanded the war to Cyprus by using its drones to hit the British Royal Air Force base at Akrotiri in Cyprus. Iran seeks to internationalize Trump's attack by making it as expensive as possible for the global economy. After heavy and sustained war, the Gulf states have so far at least avoided escalation. For months, Saudi Arabia had warned Trump of what would happen if he attacked Iran. Trump brushed off their concerns, and now they are paying a heavy price. Riyadh has good reasons for caution. It has maintained a ceasefire with the Houthis in northern Yemen, and they have yet to get involved. There are two main scenarios now for Iran. Either this attack will break them and engineer a total collapse, or the regime under a new Ayatollah and new military leader will retain control and exhaust America and Israel's and the Gulf's stock of air defense missiles. And that then will lead to a ceasefire. The killing of Khamenei during Ramadan could in fact be the spark that rejuvenates the Iranian revolution, giving it new purpose. This in itself would constitute victory, because Iran knows that the weak link in this war is Trump himself. If Iran collapses, then we can be sure of devastating consequences across the Gulf. Regime collapse and the resulting chaos or civil war has the capacity to send millions of refugees westwards. Nor will Netanyahu's war have necessarily ended if Iran collapses. Israel is betting on the weakness of the Arab states to defend themselves and seeks to weaken them further. For it is only in the landscape of a weakened neighborhood that Israel can redraw the map of the Middle East and institute a new Sykes-Picot. Then it is only a matter of time before Netanyahu declares Turkey to be Israel's next Amalek. This is a bleak scenario, but an all too realistic one. The future map of the Middle East is at stake in this war, and no Arab state can afford the luxury of sitting this one out.
That was David Hurst, editor-in-chief of Middle East Eye. More information about that is at MiddleEastEye.net. You're listening to Arab Voices, a syndicated radio talk show that airs on dozens of radio stations in the US and Europe since 2002. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. You heard David Hurst in the previous segment mentioning Greater Israel, that apartheid Israel has been pursuing and not hiding its intentions for the so-called Greater Israel, to basically take over other countries. I'm going to air now a segment produced by Breakthrough News titled Greater Israel Explained, the Israeli plan to conquer the Arab world. Although this segment was produced by Breakthrough News in late 2024, I thought it is worth sharing it again with you. Let's listen, and the voice you will hear is that of Kay Pritzker, a New York-based journalist and activist with Breakthrough News.
What is Greater Israel? This recently came up after this article in one of the main English-language Israeli newspapers, the Jerusalem Post, went viral. The article was called, "Is Lebanon Part of Israel's Promised Territory?" and it explains the origins of a concept called Greater Israel. The article reads, "In the last generation, the term Greater Israel has come to the forefront. It's sometimes used in political or religious discussions about the ideal or future borders of Israel, often in the context of messianic or Zionist aspirations. Some interpret it as a call for the reestablishment of Israel's biblical borders. However, the concept varies in meaning, ranging from symbolic or spiritual interpretations to literal geographic claims." Greater Israel has been a topic of discussion, especially after Israel's attacks in Lebanon, which revealed a deeper desire within Israel's extreme right to actually begin Jewish settlement in Lebanon. The so-called Israeli Movement for Settlement in Southern Lebanon posted a map of the sites of prospective Jewish settlements with all the Arabic names replaced with Hebrew names. This ideology has had a resurgence lately, largely because Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu formed his coalition government with Messianic Zionist parties. There's a whole documentary by TRT about this called Holy Redemption, Stealing Palestinian Land, and it's worth watching, but this video will focus on the history of the concept. The article in the Jerusalem Post was taken down, but you can read it by using an internet archive site like archive.org, and the article says, quote, "Greater Israel refers to the concept of the biblical boundaries of the land of Israel as promised to the Jewish people in various parts of the Torah. It's often associated with the land described in the covenant with Abraham, which stretches from the river of Egypt to the Prat River." And then it quotes the Torah, "When Hashem, God, promised Abraham the land of Israel, the verse says, 'On that day, God made a covenant with Abraham, saying, to your descendants I have given this land from the river of Egypt to the great river, the Euphrates,' which is Mesopotamia or modern-day Iraq." While it has religious origins, the Greater Israel concept is referenced from the very first days of the Zionist movement. The Zionist movement was the movement of European Jews who wanted Jews in Europe to move to Palestine to create a Jewish state. One of the first mentions of Greater Israel is written in the founder of the Zionist movement, Theodor Herzl's diary in 1898, just 1 year after the first Zionist Congress. On page 711 of his diary, Herzl describes the geographic proposal for a hypothetical Jewish state and says that the area demanded will be from the Brook of Egypt to the Euphrates. He then goes on to describe how this area will be slowly transferred from an Arab majority to a Jewish majority. The Zionist movement first presented this map showing what a future Jewish state would look like at the Paris Peace Conference in 1919, the conference where the World War I surrender terms were being signed. The empires that had won the war, Britain, France, Italy, and Japan, were dividing up the colonies of the losers, the Ottoman and German empires. One of the territories the Ottoman Empire lost was this area here, the Levant. The Levant is the heart of 3,000 years of Arab civilization. For centuries, they lived under the Ottoman Empire, but the empire's collapse during World War I brought hope that Arabs might finally be able to govern themselves. Instead of that, however, the Allied powers took over and created entirely new countries based on completely arbitrary boundaries. The map of the Middle East we know today was literally drawn with pencils and straight edges at a meeting at 10 Downing Street in London, which is the British Prime Minister's office, by two British and French diplomats named Mark Sykes and François Picot. Under the all-too-familiar colonial guise of protecting minorities, the European powers drew states that intentionally divided the region along the lines of sect. This is deeply ironic because Arabs are often accused of being sectarian, that religious and ethnic conflict is just part of their culture. But these distinctions between Christians and Muslims, Shia and Sunni, Arab and Kurd, were really exploited and exaggerated by the British and French, not Arabs. They literally tried to bake conflict into these countries, a legacy which still hasn't gone away today. This divide and conquer strategy is the textbook strategy of colonialism and can be observed in just about every single colonial situation in history. Part of the British strategy in Palestine was to hand over their mandate to the pro-Western, pro-colonial Zionist movement. The Paris Peace Conference of 1919, where the British and French were dividing up the spoils of World War I, is where the Zionist movement first presented its proposal for the borders of a future Jewish state. The map presented by then-leading Zionist activist and future first prime minister of Israel, David Ben-Gurion, was drawn by the World Zionist Organization and included the East Bank, which is the eastern side of the Jordan River, part of southern Lebanon, and the Egyptian Sinai. The map was rejected by Britain and France, and what followed was a long debate over what the borders of the future Jewish state should be. One of the leading proponents of expansive settlement was this guy, Zev Jabotinsky, a leader of the hard-right revisionist wing of the Zionist movement. At the 1931 Zionist Congress, Jabotinsky actually split the Zionist movement over the question of Transjordan being included in a future Jewish state because he felt it was such a crucial aspect. This is notable because Jabotinsky is considered the ideological forefather of the Likud party, the party of Benjamin Netanyahu. His most famous writing, The Iron Wall, is an essay he wrote in 1923 that argued that there would never be a voluntary agreement over European settlement in Palestine because, in his own words, there's never been a historical instance of a colonial project getting consent from the native population. He argued the only way a Jewish state could be established is if Jewish settlers create an iron wall which the natives couldn't breach. The essay is only 7 pages long, and it's definitely worth reading. Israel declares independence in 1948, but in its entire history, Israel's never actually defined its own borders. Israel's borders have changed almost constantly in its 70-year history because it's always conquering or trying to conquer more land. In 1948, Israel expelled Palestinians into neighboring countries to create a Jewish-majority state. In 1967, Israel fought the Six-Day War. The popular Israeli narrative of this war is that all of the Arab governments woke up one day and randomly attacked Israel because they hate Jews. But the truth is, Israel provoked a war with the Arab states intentionally. This was openly admitted by several high-level Israeli generals after the war. Matthew Peled, one of the Israeli commanders in the Six-Day War, told the Israeli newspaper Haaretz, "The thesis that the danger of genocide was hanging over us in June 1967 and that Israel was fighting for its physical existence is only a bluff, which was born and developed after the war." In the 1967 war, Israel conquers all of historic Palestine, the Egyptian Sinai, and the Syrian Golan Heights, more than doubling its territory. The UN does force Israel to return the Sinai, but Israel refuses to leave the Syrian Golan Heights, which is still under Israeli occupation today. One of the major turning points for Israel is its 1982 invasion of Lebanon. It was Israel's first attempt at a major occupation of a country outside of historic Palestine. But even before Israel's invasion, it had been using Christian sects in Lebanon as proxies to fight the Palestinian liberation fighters in the south of the country. Lebanese Christian fascists famously served as the trigger pullers in the Israeli-orchestrated Sabra and Shatila massacres, where 3,000 Palestinian refugees were executed over the course of a day and a half in what the UN General Assembly condemned as an act of genocide. One of the visions for Israel's long-term strategic outlook to come out of this invasion was laid out by an aide to the Israeli Minister of Defense at the time, Ariel Sharon. The strategy paper, called A Strategy for Israel in the 1980s, which was published by the World Zionist Organization's ideological journal, Kivunim, or Directions in Hebrew, explains in thorough detail how Israel should exploit the sectarian divisions in other Arab countries, as they did in Lebanon, in a larger strategy to fracture the Arab world. It says, quote, "The Muslim Arab world is built like a temporary house of cards, put together by foreigners without the wishes and desires of the inhabitants having been taken into account. It was arbitrarily divided into 19 states, all made of combinations of minorities and ethnic groups which are hostile to one another, so that every Arab Muslim state nowadays faces ethnic social destruction from within, and in some, a civil war is already raging." Then it goes on to say, "Syria is fundamentally no different from Lebanon. The real civil war taking place nowadays between the Sunni majority and the Shia Alawite ruling minority testifies to the severity of the domestic trouble. Iraq is, once again, no different in essence from its neighbors, although its majority is Shia and the ruling minority is Sunni." It then lays out its strategy for what it calls the Eastern Front. The dissolution of Syria and Iraq later on into ethnically or religiously unique areas such as in Lebanon is Israel's primary target. In the long run, while the dissolution of the military power of those states serves as the primary short-term target, Syria will fall apart in accordance with its ethnic and religious structure. This state of affairs will be the guarantee for peace and security in the area in the long run, meaning for Israel, and that aim is already within our reach today. If you observe the strategy followed by Benjamin Netanyahu throughout his career, it follows this strategy almost exactly. In 2002, he urged Congress to invade Iraq over the weapons of mass destruction it never had. The U.S. occupation plunged Iraq into a bloody sectarian civil war by manipulating balances between the Shia and Sunni Muslims. In Syria, Israel held an official position of neutrality, but later admitted to arming the mostly Sunni rebels while simultaneously carrying out regular attacks against the government, which was controlled by Shia Alawites, in a situation where neutrality actually meant for Israel undermining both sides in a civil war. And of course, in Lebanon today, we see Israel collectively punishing the Lebanese people and then telling non-Muslims to blame Muslims for Israeli airstrikes. My question for you is, how long will you tolerate this? Israel has killed over 40,000 people in Gaza. And if you include non-combat deaths, that number is conservatively estimated to be around 200,000. Immediately after committing the most well-documented attempt to wipe out an entire city in history, Israel turns around and commits an attack that turns civilian mobile devices into a theater of war, kills around 1,000 people in the span of 2 or 3 days, and then assassinates the very person likely to trigger a regional war. Israel has proven at every single juncture in the last year that it is the greatest threat to world peace right now. I've heard a lot of people describe this as the cause of our time. And while there are very few moments in history where there's a system of government that's so inhumane and so repugnant that the world unites against it, it has happened. And if Israel's actions don't merit that, then what does? The passage of a UN resolution calling for an arms embargo against Israel was a good start, but it actually needs to be enforced. And I'll just say on a parting note that the cartoonish caricature of the Middle East as a region that's just hopelessly condemned to thousand-year-old ethnic and religious conflicts is one of the greatest lies that's ever been perpetuated in the post-9/11 era. This narrative, which convinced millions of people that turmoil and conflict were intrinsic parts of Arab society, concealed the reality that these were really intrinsic parts of British and French colonial strategy and US world domination. After the 1919 Paris Peace Conference, an American fact-finding mission was created to survey the opinions of the people of the Levant to see what kind of future government they wanted. Taken in 1919, the King Crane Commission surveyed 1,520 villages in Syria, Lebanon, Palestine, and Transjordan. Of the 2.5 million Muslims, 500,000 Christians, 100,000 Jews, and 100,000 Druze that were surveyed, a full 80% of respondents voted for this option here. Greater Syria, which was the concept for a unified pan-Arab state that would have combined Lebanon, Palestine, Syria, and Transjordan into one country. Greater Syria obviously never came into fruition because it would have been unacceptable to the colonial powers of the time, but it's interesting to think back on given what we know today. The whole thesis of that 1982 Israeli strategy memo was premised on the idea that Pan-Arabism was dead. But if anything, the last year has shown us that Pan-Arabism is still highly relevant, not just to the question of Palestine, but the region as a whole. For the last 30 years, Israel's been normalizing its presence in the region by making peace agreements with Arab states one by one, thereby isolating the issue of Palestine and creating a permanent beachhead for US and Israeli imperialism. But the last year not only shattered this possibility, it showed definitively that the mass of Arab people still considered the Palestinian cause an Arab cause and a cause of their own, and refused to see it abandoned like their leaders have. It's not surprising that the 1982 memo was contingent on the absence of Arab unity. Unity has always spelled the downfall of empires, and Israel isn't likely to be an exception.
That was Kay Pritzker with Breakthrough News at www.breakthroughnews.org. You've been listening to Arab Voices, a syndicated radio talk show that airs on dozens of radio stations in the US and Europe since 2002. Our shows are archived online, and you can listen to them by visiting arabvoices.net. And that does it for the show today. Thanks for listening. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Until we meet next week, peace on earth.